The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Smithsonian.com. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. This bread was made using 4,500-year-old Egyptian yeast. After extracting the dormant yeast from cooking vessels, an amateur gastroenterologist used ancient grains to recreate an Old Kingdom loaf. By Jason Daly. Seamus Blackley, best known as one of the minds behind the Xbox, is a hardcore amateur baker and an Egyptologist. Recently, he decided to combine his two hobbies. As Alex Kroger at the BBC reports, along with the University of Queensland archaeologist and ancient brewing expert Serena Love, he negotiated access to 4,500-year-old kingdom vessels used to bake bread and make beer from the Peabody Essex Museum and Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Richard Bowman, a doctoral candidate in microbiology at the University of Iowa, helped in the process, injecting a nutrient solution into the ceramics which reawakened dormant yeasts. The team then extracted the yeasty liquid. While most of the yeast was sent off to a laboratory for study, Blackley took one sample home, setting out to recreate the taste of ancient Egypt by baking with its yeast. It's such a magical thing to think we can share food in a rather genuine way with our distant ancestors. Blackley writes on Twitter, "While it's possible that humans began making some form of bread as early as about 30,000 years ago, they didn't begin using yeast to produce beer, wine, and leavened bread until about 6,000 years ago. Since then, yeast used for producing food has undergone a lot of changes, with strains from around the world combining with one another and picking up mutations along the way. It's likely that the yeast the team captured is the real deal. While previous experiments have scraped the interiors of the bowl, which could easily be contaminated, and other techniques destroy the bowls to gain access to the yeast, this method is non-invasive. You pump a fluid in carefully with a syringe and some sterile cotton in contact with the ceramics. It soaks in and you vacuum it back out," Bowman tells Will Pavia at the Times. Genomic sequencing will conclude whether the ancient yeast is the real deal or contaminated with modern microbes. In the meantime, Blackley couldn't resist baking with his sample. He cultivated the yeast for a week using unfiltered olive oil, hand-milled barley, and einkorn, one of the earliest forms of wheat, until he had a starter, like that used to make sourdough bread. Sarah Casconi at ArtNet News reports that he mixed the starter with barley, einkorn, and kamut, all of which would have been at an ancient Egyptian baker's disposal. "Modern wheat was invented long after these organisms went to sleep," he says. "The idea is to make dough with identical ingredients to what the yeast ate 4,500 years ago." Blackley documented his bread-baking adventure on his Twitter profile. He noted that the scent as it baked was different from other loaves of bread he's made, with the same combination of ancient grains, but with modern yeast. "It's much sweeter and more rich than the sourdough we are used to. It's a big difference," he wrote. Describing the look and taste of it, Blackley noted that the crumb is light and airy, particularly for a 100% ancient grain loaf. "The aroma and flavor are incredible," he added. "I'm emotional. It's really different, and you can easily tell even if you're not a bread nerd. This is incredibly exciting, and I'm so amazed that it worked." That being said, Blackley was careful to note that this loaf was just for practice, and he's sure some modern yeast likely contaminated the sample. He hopes to try again with a purer strain of Old Kingdom yeast and has future plans to work with Love to replicate the tools and baking methods, like cooking bread in ceramic pots used by the ancient Egyptians. He also wants to work with a ceramist to recreate the cooking vessels. Already, the team has secured permission to collect samples from cooking pots in other museums. And they hope to gather the yeast from the Old, Middle, and New Kingdoms, each separated by 500 to 700 years, to understand if and how the yeasts change over time. Luckily, we have something to go along with the Pharaoh's bread. Last year, the British Museum tasked a team with figuring out how to brew beer using ancient Egyptian methods, which produced suds similar to white wine. Jason Daly is a Madison, Wisconsin-based writer specializing in natural history, science, travel, and the environment. His work has appeared in Discover, Popular Science, Outside, Men's Journal, and other magazines. Up next, The Truth About Blue Eyes by Kat LaFuente. Pale Blue Eyes by The Velvet Underground. Sweet Child of Mine by Guns N' Roses. I Still Miss Someone by Johnny Cash. Those are just a few of the utterly ubiquitous amounts of songs there are about blue eyes, usually about someone yearning or pining for a lover with eyes the color of the sky. So there's definitely a cultural obsession with those of the blue-eyed persuasion, whether it's celebrating their unique beauty or expressing fear about their alleged icy cold hearts. All emotions and broken hearts aside, there's a lot to learn about not just blue eyes themselves, but also the people who peer out at the world through them, whether it's due to weird scientific facts, related health conditions, or just plain genetics. Those with baby blues are just a bit different than their brown-eyed counterparts. So, without further ado, read on to learn the truth about blue eyes and the population of people who have them. Even though blue eyes appear to be, well, blue, they're actually not blue at all. It sounds crazy, but there's no such thing as blue pigment when it comes to our peepers. You're either melanated or not very melanated at all. And if you're melanated in each layer of the iris, like the majority of the human race, then you would have brown eyes that are actually brown. No optical illusions there. So if there's no pigment in the front layers of the iris of blue-eyed people, there is some melanin in the back layer, what mechanism is at work that makes them look blue? According to the American Academy of Ophthalmology, blue eyes look blue for the same reason that both the ocean and the sky appear to be blue. It's simply a trick of the light. This is called the Tyndall effect, which is the way that light scatters in blue eyes, giving rise to the blue appearance. Fascinating? No? Although there are a ton of actors, models, and other celebs who have blue eyes, which can make these colored eyes seem like a common asset, at least on television, not all that many people are lucky enough to boast baby blues. In fact, the most common eye color throughout the entire world is brown, according to an article in World Atlas. Specifically, 79% of human beings have eyes the color of coffee and chocolate, dwarfing every other eye color as the dominant phenotype. So just how many people have blue eyes around the world? World Atlas estimates that approximately 8 to 10% of human beings are blessed with cerulean peepers. Of course, plenty of folks who don't have blue eyes can fake it with contacts, as celebs like Selena Gomez and Nicki Minaj have done on occasion. But you can always tell the difference between a natural blue and an artificial blue, and it's a pretty hard color to fake. Although the odds of having blue eyes are markedly lower than having brown eyes, blue isn't the rarest of all eye colors. In fact, it's actually the second most common eye color out there, according to an article in World Atlas. which is a little surprising, given that 8 to 10% isn't exactly a huge swath of the population. But it turns out that having hazel eyes is less common than having either blue or brown eyes, as only 5% of people have that color in their irises. Additionally, approximately 5% of the world's population have amber-colored eyes, although sometimes this is confused with the hazel pattern. Less common than either of those shades is green, as only 2% of the world's population is blessed with that phenotype. The most rare eye colors in the world are gray eyes, red, violet eyes, which are often in people with severe forms of albinism, and eyes with heterochromia, different colored eyes, all clocking in at less than 1% of all people worldwide. They're the real unicorns here. Blue eyes can appear to be more or less common, depending on where in the world you are, as the phenotype is much more common in some places. In fact, sometimes the majority of people in an area have blue eyes. For example, if you were strolling through Estonia or taking a vacation in Finland, not having blue eyes would be rare, as 89% of the populations of those countries have azure irises, according to World Atlas. That's a lot. After that, there's a significant drop, although blue eyes are still the majority in Ireland and Scotland, at 57% and 50% respectively. England is next on the list with 48%, while 45% of people in Wales have baby blues. I love the variety on Smithsonian. Here's one for you. How mosquitoes helped shape the course of human history. Historian and author Timothy Weingard discusses the way mosquitoes have played a major role in battles, genetics, and the gin and tonic. By Emily Toomey. 52 billion people, almost half of the cumulative human population, are thought to have perished at the hands of a creature no bigger than a fingernail, the mosquito. In his new book, The Mosquito, A Human History of Our Deadliest Predator, historian Timothy Weingard exposes this insect as not merely an itchy pest, but a force of nature that has dictated the outcome of significant events throughout human history, from ancient Athens to World War II. Weingard highlights key moments when mosquito-borne diseases caused militaries to crumble, great leaders to fall, and populations to be left vulnerable to invasion. In addition to addressing the mosquito's pivotal role in battle, Weingard reveals some uglier effects of its diseases, such as how malarial resistance contributed to the rise of the African slave trade and the concept of biological warfare. Weingard spoke with Smithsonian about his new book and if modern technology can defeat this threat to humanity and whether it should. A lot of people acknowledge that insects, despite being pesky and annoying, have an important role in our overall ecosystem. Do mosquitoes contribute anything other than just being a parasite? We don't know yet if mosquitoes have absolute purpose ecologically. The males to drink nectar and populate plants, but not to the degree that other insects do, like bees. They don't ingest waste, like some other insects do. As far as we know, they don't serve an indispensable food source for any other animal. So, no, looking at the historical impact of the mosquito, perhaps their role is a Malthusian check against uncontrolled population growth, and within ecological balance and equilibrium of Mother Nature. A pioneering and groundbreaking work of narrative nonfiction that offers a dramatic new perspective on the history of humankind shows how through millennia the mosquito has been the single most powerful force in determining humanity's fate. What are some of the most common misconceptions people have about mosquitoes? In countries that are relatively free of mosquito-borne disease or have been free of mosquito-borne disease for the last half century, we tend to think that they're just annoying pests. We fail to realize that they're a global problem, especially with trade, travel, and the increased mobility of human populations. There are over 100 trillion mosquitoes on the planet at any given moment. That's the estimate. It's a universal problem that requires a universal solution. Your book deals with adaptation. Both mosquitoes evolved resistance to chemicals and human adaptations, like sickle cell or Duffy negative, to mosquito-borne disease. How do the timelines of these two adaptations compare to each other? Evidence suggests that mosquitoes evolve quicker than humans, but the human response to what would have been unrelenting malaria in Africa, the sickle cell nature selection, hereditary gene, is unbelievable. It is a testament to the sheer power malaria had on early populations in Africa that humans developed sickle cell through natural selection so incredibly quickly. Do other animals have genetic adaptations to mosquitoes, or is it mainly humans that have traits like sickle cell or Duffy negativity? Great apes seem to have adapted to malaria, where they carry the parasite, but it doesn't cause symptoms. The same with reptiles and amphibians. They also carry malaria parasites, different from the ones with humans, and they've adapted to show very mild or no symptoms. All creatures on the planet want to survive, and natural selection is essentially forcing or promoting their ability to do that. One fact that surprised me in your book was that mosquito-borne diseases didn't exist in the Americas prior to European arrival. Can you explain why? 75% of the diseases are what we call spillover zoonotic transfer, meaning animal sickness that's carried from animals themselves. Smallpox, measles, mumps, they all come from various animals. In the pre-Columbian America, very few animals were domesticated. The ones that were, like the turkey, essentially domesticated themselves by loitering for scraps. They didn't really require helicopter parenting or supervision. The domestication of animals in the Middle East and Europe allowed for the transference of diseases to humans. Agriculture was also practiced differently in other parts of the world compared to the Americas. It was not a predominantly surplus agricultural economy in the Americas, so there wasn't as much disturbance of local environments. Agriculture led to higher population densities in Europe and in Africa, which allowed disease to spread more quickly and continued the cyclical contagion. Your book argues that mosquito-borne diseases have determined the outcome of many battles throughout history, from Athens to World War II. Do you think most people realize the influence of disease in warfare, or do you think society still prefers viewing things from a perspective of manpower, weaponry, and resources? General modern histories find pestilence and disease rather dull when compared to national supermen, which are most often military generals. Not to take away from anything that these men and women did, but historians tend to promote their prowess rather than looking at some of their external factors that influence history. The mosquito was an earth-shattering external factor, especially in wars, because you have armies moving across territory that is foreign to them, as are the microbes in the lands that they move to. We're beginning to dig a bit deeper into other factors that have shaped history, and obviously the mosquito is a paramount agent and driving force of historical changes in trajectory. In some of the first cases of biological warfare, mosquitoes make an appearance, starting with ancient armies fighting in malaria-filled marshes and fast-forwarding to Nazis intentionally unleashing mosquitoes outside of Rome. Did mosquitoes inspire the idea of biological warfare in general? Up until the late 19th century, we didn't actually know what caused mosquito-borne diseases. The prevailing thought was the miasma theory, which stated the cause was noxious and toxic mists and odors emanating from standing water in swamps. If we look back in history, we can see perhaps the swamps themselves being used as a biological weapon, but not the mosquitoes that threaten the swamps. But the Nazis reflooded the Pontine marshes in Italy purposely to introduce malarial mosquitoes. My wife's grandfather actually contracted malaria at Anzio as a consequence of this deliberate act of biological warfare by the Nazis. The role of mosquitoes in the development of the African slave trade is obviously a difficult and charged subject. Can you explain that connection? It's a sensitive subject, as the African slave trade is one of the paramount horrors in human history. Because mosquito-borne disease is ancestral to Africa, more Africans developed genetic resistance to malaria. And then at the same time, they had acquired immunity to yellow fever. So when the indigenous populations of the Americas were no longer a viable option for a slave labor force, with the near extermination or 95% death rate of indigenous people across the Americas, partly from malaria and yellow fever, a substitute was needed. It also became very obvious that when European indentured servants or European laborers died in the colonial hotbeds of mosquito-borne disease, more Africans survived, so the acquired immunity to yellow fever in Africa unfortunately created a problem and an environment where Africans themselves became profitable on plantation colonies in the Americas. How did mosquitoes play a role in changing the course of the American Civil War? It's interesting to look at the mosquito's role in the Civil War as twofold. The first is that after the first Battle of Bull Run, it became clear that this wasn't going to be a short war and that it was going to drag on. In 1862, primarily, what you have is Union forces heading south into Confederate territory. So you're bringing unseasoned northern soldiers into mosquito hotbeds, and they succumb to mosquito-borne disease on a far greater scale than Confederate troops do. The mosquito prolongs the war. And then the second factor is when the Union blockade of the Confederacy begins to take hold. The Union has ample supplies of quinine, which is the anti-malarial treatment at the time, while the Confederacy starts to be starved out of all resources, including quinine. Then you see the mosquito essentially switch sides, the fickle ally, and attack Confederate forces in the South with mosquito-borne disease cases in far greater percentages than the Union. So the mosquito starts to eat away at Confederate forces, thereby helping secure Union victory. When you were writing and researching this book, what specific event was most surprising to you? One would be my wife's grandfather's story about contracting malaria twice during the Second World War, first with deliberate flooding of the Pontine marshes, and the second time when his regiment helped liberate the Dachau concentration camp, which was the headquarters of the Nazi tropical medicine program. There were experimental mosquitoes, and he contracted malaria again. He had no idea how any of this happened until the spring of 2017, when I told him about all of the events surrounding his malarial ordeals during the Second World War. But on a larger scale, it was amazing to see how very little of our history has not been changed, altered, impacted by the mosquito, from small things like the gin and tonic in India to the larger components of the mosquito's historical influence, like its help in facilitating the British surrender at Yorktown. The mosquito has had a sweeping influence across human history. Humans have been battling against this tiny thing for pretty much our entire existence. Looking forward, do we stand a chance? Or are we just doomed to keep trying chemicals or treatments that the mosquito continuously adapts to? With the emergence of CRISPR, it's apparently an acronym for gene editing technology, we're faced with an interesting choice in regards to the mosquito, or for any other animal for that matter, including human beings. It seems like we've opened Pandora's box in a way. A lot of questions are being asked currently about moral and legal implications. It's almost as if Jurassic Park could become real and science fiction vanishes into nonfiction. With CRISPR, there's two ways to look at our war with mosquitoes. One is to exterminate the mosquito by way of genetic manipulation using CRISPR, where we would CRISPR male mosquitoes and release them, and they would breed with females. And then the offspring would be stillborn, infertile, or male, which would obviously bring the mosquito closer to extinction. The other viable option would be to genetically engineer mosquitoes to make them incapable of actually vectoring the mosquito-borne diseases themselves. So we would conquer the mosquito-borne disease without conquering the mosquito itself, making it relatively harmless except for the bite and the normal itch that everyone across the planet has felt. You write about the lack of research on mosquito-borne diseases in comparison to others. What determines which diseases get priority in terms of money and research? The largest factor is personal experience and investment with that disease or fear of that disease. Countries that have been relatively free of mosquito-borne disease tend to forget because that's not personal experience with diseases like malaria or yellow fever. That's starting to change with the rise of emerging mosquito-borne diseases in the United States, Canada, and some of the wealthier Western countries where we're seeing Zika and West Nile. It's becoming more prevalent in the media as people are coming more face-to-face with the reality of mosquito-borne disease in their own backyards. Emily Toomey is a mass media fellow at Smithsonian Magazine. We'll finish up with a couple letters from readers of Smithsonian. I was in Phuc Vinh, South Vietnam, during the moon landing because the locals usually spoke of a person acting crazy as, quote, going to the moon. I heard a lot of Vietnamese saying that the Americans have gone crazy. That's from Michael Stan Campiano, Ocean Shores, Washington. And Richard Shagram writes, it should be fairly obvious to readers of this article that if we hadn't had the Apollo program, we probably wouldn't be sitting in front of a large computer screen or holding a smartphone reading about it. And of course, a whole list of other technologies that might not have been developed either. Thank you, NASA, and the politicians of this country who supported it for changing the world. And from Ask Smithsonian, why don't people smile in old photographs? Although we tend to think the subjects had to hold their faces still for an uncomfortably long time, exposures from the early days of commercial photography only lasted about 5 to 15 seconds. The real reason is that, in the mid-19th century, photography was so expensive and uncommon that this photograph might be the only one they'd ever have made. Rather than flash a grin, they often opted to look thoughtful and serious. And that's our clue to wrap it up. I hope you've enjoyed this edition of Smithsonian. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for that support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast will be available on our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's a new website address, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. Address any comments or questions to us at 919-832-5138.